This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 65 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. So last week, someone asked me a question about picking up fringe players, like a handcuff, and then dropping that player for a kicker if that player, after he performed, would become sort of worthless in fantasy football in the next week. In other words, you pick up a dude, make sure there are kickers available that play on Sunday or Monday night, and then drop that player or someone else on your bench for a kicker prior to those Monday night and Sunday night games being played. I mentioned that I'm all about using the kicker spot for an additional player throughout the week, but I was unaware that the default settings on Yahoo allowed you to drop bench players who had already played. But man, you guys definitely let me know that. So I apologize, and yes, that is a good strategy. If you want to utilize it, pick someone up off the waiver wire like James Conner for your kicker this weekend, because if something happens to Le'Veon Bell in those earlier games, you then already have James Conner. If not, you can then just drop James Conner. This is real. You can drop James Conner for a kicker that's playing a later game. That's how the strategy works, whereas on most platforms and in most leagues, you're locked out. So instead, just use your kicker spot for a player through the week until things lock up at 1 p.m. Eastern on Sunday. Rather than get back to all of you who pointed this out, I figured I'd just talk about it here in the intro. Again, I'm really sorry for not being aware that Yahoo has stupid default rules. It appears as though my commissioners have changed things up a bit, which is part of the reason why I did not know. But I do have one league, now that I'm aware, where you can do this. It's dumb, but it's also a very good way to exploit this game of fantasy football. Today's another mailbag episode, but before I dig in, I wanted to remind you guys about this awesome contest that's going on over on FanDuel. Starting this week, me, Brandon Gadula, and Jim Sonnes of NumberFire.com will be playing against FanDuel Friends Mode Commissioners in the NumberFire Showdown. To qualify, just be a FanDuel Friends Mode League Commissioner and have your contest run for cash. That gets you into the $1,000 commish free play the next week. Finish in the top three in the free play, and you'll take on me, Brandon, and Jim the following week. If you win, you get $1,000 or more. But if one of us experts wins, we don't get anything, and FanDuel adds $500 to the next week's prize pool until a commish claims it. If you want to learn more about how you can play against me in this very special FanDuel contest, you can visit FanDuel.com/NumberFireShowdown. That's FanDuel.com/NumberFireShowdown. Okay, it's mailbag time. This first question is from Jeff. Hi, JJ. Love the podcast and especially the non-binary nature of your insight. Hopefully this question is in that spirit. How do you treat weekly starters that are on the injury report but anticipated to play a full game? In other words, limited practices each day in a questionable tag. For example, a lot has been made of Stefon Diggs' injury report splits, but it's a small sample size with a lot of noise, and a couple of his playing injured games are perfectly acceptable starts. Is it better to simply lower a player's ceiling rather than automatically lower their medium outcome or assume that a bust outcome is more likely? And would this affect how you construct your starting lineup in a given week, either by starting a healthy but more boom or bust player from a tier below over that said injured player, or trying to find more boom opportunity elsewhere in the lineup? Thanks for the great work, Jeff. Like plenty of questions, this one is answered with a, it depends. The problem with making a blanket statement about something like this is that, as we know, injuries vary greatly. The severity of each injury is different despite each of these injuries having a questionable tag. So you have to unfortunately take this case by case. It's true that Diggs has kind of disappeared and not performed when he's been on the injury report, but that also has to do with the type of injury that he's dealing with. For instance, if a running back has something like a hand injury, but reports out of camp say that a running back is handling reps well and didn't fumble in practice, then I'm not all that concerned about that injury. If a running back has a hamstring or groin injury, that matters a bit more because we know that a running back runs the ball a lot. You need a healthy groin and hamstring to run the ball effectively. And then this will impact how I'm constructing my lineup. I would generally lower my expectations for seriously injured players from both a ceiling and floor standpoint, so it may either force me to bench that player or at least force me to get a little more variance or more of a ceiling in my lineup for that given week. I hope that makes sense. And my goodness, can Stefon Diggs please, please, please get healthy? This next one's from Justin. Hi, JJ. I'm in a 12-team start, two running backs, two wide receivers, and a flex with 0.25 PPR. Thanks to you, I was able to make some early season running back transactions off the waiver wire and ended up with a stable of Christian McCaffrey, Doug Martin, Elijah McGuire, Alvin Kamara, Andre Ellington, Aaron Jones, plus Danny Woodhead sitting on IR. Thinking I was overloaded at running back and in need of some wide receiver help, I traded McCaffrey and Demaryius Thomas for DeAndre Hopkins. I might have overpaid a bit, but I now have the number two scoring wide receiver in our league. My question is, if you can acquire a top three scorer at a position with a high floor slash high ceiling each week, is there such thing as overpaying if you are giving up two inconsistent performers, albeit with high upside like McCaffrey and Thomas? Thanks for all the great work you do, Justin. I think questions like this usually depend on three things: league size, bench size, and current roster situation. If you've got a loaded roster with a bunch of wide receiver twos and running back twos, then your goal should be to pair those players up to get a clear-cut RB1 or wide receiver one. Because having RB2s and wide receiver twos rot on your bench is doing you no good in the long run. This is why it's good to have depth coming out of your fantasy draft. It's good to go late round quarterback or late round tight end because it enables you to get this depth. It allows you to have a higher chance of hitting on players, and in turn, you'll have more depth to trade or to make up for a bust. Anyway, that's why your roster construction matters. Your league size matters because naturally, the smaller the league, the better your starting lineup has to be in order to win. That and your bench means a lot less because the waiver wire is more fruitful. If you're in a 10 or 18 league, you know what I'm talking about. You should be constantly trying to trade for starter upgrades, even more so in these smaller leagues. And the same logic holds for bench sizes as well. If your bench is small, that means your waiver wire is better than if your bench size is large. If that's the case, it's easier to get rid of depth because that depth is more replaceable through the waiver wire. Now, regarding your trade, without any context, I don't think that it was an awful trade. I'm not as confident as you might be with some of your other running backs. So I may have been a little bit more hesitant in giving up Christian McCaffrey. But Hopkins is definitely the better wideout compared to Demaryius Thomas from here on out, even if Demaryius Thomas is a good buy low candidate like I talked about a couple of weeks ago on my 15 Transactions podcast. So it wasn't an awful trade, but I'm not sure if I would have done it. This next one is from Ben. Hey JJ, first off, thanks for keeping up the great content throughout the start of the season. The effort and thought you put into your work shows, and I just wanted to let you know that your audience can tell. Thanks, Ben, although I think that the audience is probably sick of hearing my voice at this point. Anyways, I have a question regarding your approach to something seeming due. I thought about this a lot when the Patriots defense stuffed the Bucks offense, and it's always in my mind with Martavis Bryant catching a deep ball or the Colts or Lions running backs never rushing for 100 yards. Sometimes it just seems like certain things are bound to happen eventually. Aside from factoring in likely regression, common advanced metrics that more accurately judge quality of play and matchups, how much, if at all, do you measure for something feeling due? Are there any analytical thoughts that go into hunches or gut feelings rather than sound arguments? Or do you try to avoid those senses and only look at verifiable measurements and probability? It's a pretty subjective question, if it even is a question at all. Keep up the great content. With gratitude, Ben. So I've got a long answer to this, so hold on to your pants. Let's first think about what it means for something to be due. In essence, it means that something that was predicted to happen hasn't happened yet. So we get this hunch that the something that we predicted would happen will happen very soon. This is sort of what regression actually is, though. Regression is saying this player should be doing this based on all of this evidence, but it hasn't happened yet. Therefore, he'll regress to his mean eventually. Now, sometimes regression has nothing to do with something being due because sometimes players aren't utilized the way that we originally thought. Let's use someone like Jamison Crowder as an example. Entering the season, he was a decently high fantasy draft pick. People were drafting him in the fifth, maybe the sixth round. And so far, he's been about as usable as the directional pad on an N64 controller. By the way, that's like my favorite analogy of all time. I love using that analogy. But where's the evidence that Jamison Crowder is due? He's seen two deep ball targets this year, he has a sub 16% target market share, and he's hit 50 yards just once this season. Crowder should not be considered a regression candidate. He shouldn't be considered due. He should just be considered not good in fantasy football. Now, you mentioned Martavis Bryant, who I think is actually a really good example in this exercise. You have to ask yourself, though, why do you feel like he's due? Is it just because he's done it in the past, or because you've seen Ben Roethlisberger miss him by inches on a deep ball time and time again this year? The evidence surrounding Martavis Bryant is what would suggest whether or not he's due. He has 13 deep ball targets this year, which is a top 10 number in the NFL. Yet, he's caught just three of those passes. So if we assume Ben Roethlisberger to Martavis Bryant is at least an average deep ball tandem, then we should probably assume that more of those deep balls will hit in the future. But here's the thing, you have to look at other things happening with Martavis Bryant. He's playing fewer and fewer snaps. He's been playing fewer snaps than Juju Smith-Schuster. Over his last three games, he's only seen 5 deep ball targets. Over his first 3 games, it was 8. So things aren't really trending up for Martavis Bryant, and therefore, he shouldn't be considered due like he was in, say, week 4. And I want to address confirmation bias here, too. Confirmation bias, according to Wikipedia, is the tendency to search for, interpret, favor, and recall information in a way that confirms one's pre-existing beliefs or hypotheses. When you have this hunch that something is going to happen and it's based on nothing more than a hunch, and then that thing happens, it allows you to believe that your hunch was correct and that there was some sort of process behind the hunch. Like the Patriots defense example that you threw out in this question. Let's pretend that you thought the Patriots D would be able to handle the Bucs offense on Thursday Night Football a couple of weeks ago. And the only reason was because it's the Patriots and because Bill Belichick is the greatest coach of all time. And then the Patriots hold Tampa to 14 points. From there, you say, I knew it. I knew New England would hold Tampa to a low total. I knew the New England defense would turn things around. I had a hunch. But here's the problem. There's a lot more depth to something like that than simply looking at points scored. In that game, Tampa had 409 yards on offense. That's pretty in line with the yardage totals that New England's given up this year. They scored 14 points, but given their yardage total, they should have scored more. So confirmation bias kicked in because the results showed that your original hypothesis was correct. You're ignoring other information like total yardage and pinpointing the thing that enables your prediction to be right, which is points scored. I do think that when we're talking about humans and predicting something that humans are going to do, like humans playing football, intuition can play some sort of role. That's why there are what people call trap games in the NFL. We're not dealing with robots here. So there are, at times, players and teams who then half-ass their play during a game. I mean, we saw that this past week. The Giants went to Denver, and Denver did not look like the normal Broncos team. It was a trap game. But too often, confirmation bias hits and makes it seem like our intuition is near flawless, because we often remember the things that confirm what we thought. Usually, though, there are reasons why things happen the way they do on a football field. When you peel back the layers, things start to make more sense. And that goes for when something is due as well. This next question is from Chris. Hi, JJ. What are your takes on some of these available players? Rob Kelly, Wendell Smallwood, Corey Davis, and John Brown. And then holding on to Buck Allen and Alex Collins, and Ty Montgomery and Aaron Jones. So the latter two examples are why I always talk about holding an entire backfield in fantasy football and how that's not an ideal strategy to implement. Sure, one player could emerge out of a backfield, but how often does one running back emerge in a backfield in today's NFL, let alone a running back without a strong collegiate or NFL profile? In those situations, I do my best to trade one of those players, especially in Baltimore. You're talking about a bad offense, whereas Alvin Kamara and Mark Ingram can actually both be usable during the same week. Or I should say, they're predictably usable. That's just as important. If you're in a PPR league, Buck Allen is going to give you some sort of floor week in and week out between him and Alex Collins. And then with Ty Montgomery and Aaron Jones, I'd just see what you can get for them. There's no clear-cut answer. I lean more towards Aaron Jones at this point because of the reasons that I talked about on this mailbag show in the past, but again, it's not a predictable usage situation each week, especially with Aaron Rodgers out of the picture. And let me also reiterate a point that I've made here in the past. There are so many players in fantasy football where their value can be seen in so many different ways. Like someone asked me yesterday what type of value you can expect in return for Ezekiel Elliott right now. I mean, I'd be lying to you if I had any idea. Everyone is going to view Zeke differently because there are things that could happen that have nothing to do with football surrounding Ezekiel Elliott. It's like asking a group of 11 people if they'd want to buy some vintage baseball card off of you. If 11 of those people aren't baseball card collectors, then you probably won't get the best value for that card. If the rest of your league mates are worried about Ezekiel Elliott and are only willing to give up a flex player for him, then you probably shouldn't deal him. This is why, for the record, I always tell people to not simply target specific players in trades, but trade assets away that the other team you're trading with could use. Assets that they want. So when you go and sell someone like Alex Collins or Ty Montgomery, don't target specific players necessarily. Target teams, and then see which players on that team can help you. See if they have buy low candidates like Adam Thielen or Julio Jones and go from there. Regarding the other players on that list, I actually don't mind any of them. My worry with Rob Kelly is that we know that he's a two-down back, and Chris Thompson is easily the best player in that Washington backfield. And his usage this past week might be telling that the Washington staff may utilize him more moving forward. I actually like Wendell Smallwood as long as he's healthy. He's the one player in that team's backfield with a three-down potential, though I fully expect them to still have a strong committee. Even still, the rushing work and receiving work when Smallwood is healthy gives him RB2 potential. We saw that in the Chargers game a few weeks back, where he had 10 carries and 6 targets. And I love both John Brown and Corey Davis. The Cardinals really need a strong perimeter receiver, and John Brown looks to finally be healthy. That's huge news for them and him, really, because it's a pass-heavy offense. He's in a very good situation. Corey Davis showed us a lot of potential in that Week 1 game against Oakland. He saw 10 targets in that contest. I've added him in a bunch of leagues, and in leagues with an IR spot, you can just throw him in that IR spot. You just have to hope that he can get healthy. I thought he'd be back on the field by now, so there is some worry. This next one is from David. He says, "What are your thoughts on IR spots? I love them, but I feel like not everyone in my league is using it, so I feel like I'm cheating by keeping Luck and Olsen in leagues. Thanks." I think IR spots are great for those stupid 3 or 4 week injuries, because you shouldn't be so harshly penalized when your player goes down for that amount of time. It's almost worse when a fringe starter on your team is out for 6 weeks than when he's just put on IR, because you're wasting a bench spot without that IR spot. With that being said, I don't like non-dynasty leagues where there's more than 2 IR spots. One, in my opinion, is enough. Otherwise, you can just hit the waiver wire and start hoarding dudes in those spots. That's where it gets annoying. This next one is from Steven. "Is the suspension being back on hold good news or bad news for Zeke owners? It almost seems to me that he'll play the next 2 weeks and then miss weeks 9 to 14, which means missing week 1 of the fantasy playoffs. What are your thoughts?" I alluded to this earlier a bit, but I really don't know what's going to happen with Ezekiel Elliott. Not only did I not go to law school, but even lawyers have no idea what's going to happen. Is there the potential that this is actually a worse outcome for fantasy owners, though? Yes. But yes and no. While he'd be out for the first portion of the playoffs, he's also helping you get there over the next 2 weeks. So it would depend how well your team is performing to this point. If you're undefeated and you have Zeke, then if we assume there's a suspension, you'd want that suspension to happen yesterday. If you're something like 3-3 with Ezekiel Elliott, then you need those wins now. You're happy that he wasn't suspended yet. That's sort of the way that I'm viewing it. This next one is from Brad. "Hey JJ, do you have a system that you use to target waiver wire acquisitions from week to week for multiple season long teams? Sometimes I get overwhelmed trying to keep track of who is available in each of my leagues, so I'm always trying to streamline my process. Thanks for all your work on the show, I'm really enjoying it. Brad." So I'm in a lot of redraft and dynasty leagues, but redraft is the format that you have to worry about the waiver wire most, quite obviously. The way my setup works and how I handle the waiver wire each week is that I have all of my leagues bookmarked in my browser. I set aside a half hour or so each week, and I just go through each league in order, setting claims and making sure my lineup looks good. My process within each league is to look at players who I want to add across all leagues. So highly addable players that are basically written about in my 15 transactions column each week, and then I'll see how they fit with my particular team. So I'll have 2 tabs open, my team page and then my waiver wire page. Almost all big name waiver wire ads at running back and wide receiver will be on my waiver wire list across all of my teams. I always want the best running backs and wide receivers possible. But if I need a quarterback streamer, I'll just peruse the wire in that league and find the best one. And then I'll add multiple in case my claim fails. Also, something that I've done that saves a lot of time is that when you're on the waiver wire page, when you go to claim a player, don't simply just click. Don't just click the add button. Click to add in another tab. That way you don't have to go back to that page, sort by the position or however you want to sort it, and then do that all over again. That takes time. And honestly, I think it's less about knowing who's available in your leagues at all times and more about having a process for checking everything and making that process as efficient as possible. This last question is from Matt. "What do your Saturdays look like? Is this your day away from the NFL and time for family? Or is this your day you binge Perfect Dark? During football season, my Saturdays are mostly non-NFL related unless there's not a lot going on. I'll watch Pitt football, my alma mater, but my college football watching is not all that intense. Usually Saturday for me is spent doing things around the house and spending quality time with my friends and my wife. I'll go to breweries, I'll do some painting around the house. It's really whatever's going on that day and what the weather looks like outside. And really what my wonderful wife is looking to do. Because she's incredibly supportive of my job and how seasonal it is. And how I disappear for 4 months of the year, constantly analyzing football and making sure that my work is done. I could not ask for a better support system, and having at least that day to spend time with my wife is really, really important to me. But yes, I do try to nerd out and play some video games as well. That's the last question though, everyone. Thanks again for tuning in and listening to me ramble on and on about this stupid game that we all love. If you've yet to subscribe to the show, please do so by going to iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, and TuneIn. Remember to also leave a rating and review on iTunes. At the end of the month, I'll be drawing one of the names who left a review at random, and that person will win a NumberFire premium subscription for an entire year. Also, don't forget to follow me on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.